It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at a Milwaukee literacy effort to help refugees and immigrants function better as parents, employees, and citizens.
First, from the Black Lives Matter movement to growing concern about racial disparities and educational outcomes, there's been a new wave of activism on issues of concern for African Americans.
But like any social and political movement, generational differences and conflicts can make setting priorities and working toward common goals difficult.
Rahel Tesfamarian is a social activist, public theologian, writer, and speaker. She's the founder and publisher of Urban Cusp, an online magazine focusing on progressive urban culture, faith, and social change. And she'll be speaking tonight on the UW-Madison campus about the intersection between different generations of the civil rights struggle. Rahel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Well, you've said that the Black church used to be kind of the control center of the civil rights movement, if you look back at the 60s, for instance. But today, that's changed. Why is the new generation of civil rights activists moving away from the church?
Right. So my argument wasn't to say that the church has always been the hub of Black liberation. I mean, I think there's always been a connection between the Black struggle for freedom and Black spirituality. But it's more so which platform has the most visibility, the most prominence, and it's not the church. The church is not the visible platform sending the message of liberation that everyone's paying attention to. The marching orders are coming in very organic ways from young people, from women, from the streets. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the fact that young people are fighting for their survival. Young people in Ferguson and Baltimore, working class folks that may not have a college education and may not be validated and legitimized in the eyes of the establishment, but their fight for survival is exactly what gives them legitimacy to be heard and be at the forefront of the movement.
Is there anything about the way that the church has traditionally functions or has functioned that's a part of this? If you look at the way the hierarchy is structured or the fact that it's usually men in the pulpit there, does any of that play into why the Black Lives Matter movement isn't centralized around the church?
Even Scripture tells us that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. So it's this idea that we can't ever get too comfortable with hierarchy, we can't get too comfortable with order and status, because in the divine world where the supernatural is always at work, things can be turned upside down overnight. And we've always known that women have been organizing, leading, protesting, resisting. We always have seen that young people are the ones driving the push for social change. That has always been the case. But what happens is that the status quo is maintained even in the fight for liberation. So those that are young get pushed to the back. Those that are middle class, working class, get pushed to the back. But I think that it comes a time when those who are fighting for their liberation understand that they cannot be silent, they cannot be invisible, and the church has to, in many ways, take its marching orders from the ones who are demanding to be heard and seen.
And you've said there's this new urgency that you see in this movement that's going on right now, and that you see more of a parallel to the Black Panthers than, say, to Dr. King's movement. Why the Black Panthers?
Well, there was, of course, SNCC. There was also the Black Panthers, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. There were so many organizations and entities mobilizing during that era. And so people were getting their marching orders from a lot of different sources, some from charismatic leaders, others from more institutional mechanisms. But I honed in on the Black Panther Party because I believe that there is an ideological shift happening in the minds of young people today. And I believe that the Black Panther Party probably reflects a lot of where their ideology is shifting towards, that you have more of this Black nationalist rhetoric, you have more Black nationalist aesthetics, you see it in this passion for natural hair, which has kind of been a wave of the way for quite a while, but now it's more political than it was before. You see it in the T-shirts, the rise of the Black fist again. So a lot of the aesthetics in Black culture are very reflective of the Black power movement. I mean, most recently in Beyonce's performance at the Super Bowl, And so I think there was some of the rhetoric and the ideology and the imagery given to us by the Black Panther Party that wasn't by, say, these other institutions. Now, the strategies of SNCC may be reflective today, but I think the Black Panther Party did a great job of, in some ways, branding liberation and connecting it to what you wore and what you said and how you looked at the world.
You wrote about a protest that was led by the Reverend Al Sharpton sort of in the more early days of the Black Lives Matter movement, and that it was sort of stormed by counter-protesters who wanted to do things a little differently. Do you think that there is a tension between that first generation of Black activists and the generation of new activists that are working and advocating today?
I believe that there's always been a generational tension. Even if you look at the civil rights movement, even in that moment, you see a tension where young people are saying, time is now, and elders are saying, wait your turn. I mean, I can't imagine a moment in history where that tension hasn't existed. I think what's happening now is in many ways a continuation of that same struggle that young people are saying, our time is now. And a lot of the elders in the movement, their passion may still be there for issues of justice, but they're also trying to sustain themselves financially. They're also trying to maintain their livelihood. This is, in many ways, their job. So they're trying to do their job. And in doing their job, may not have taken the time to nurture the next generation of freedom fighters. And so there can oftentimes be a sense of resentment that you want the platform versus teaching me how to have the platform, that you don't honor my voice, you don't respect me, and why should I respect you if you don't respect me? There's without a doubt a generational tension, but there's a class tension. There's a gender tension. You know, there are so many tensions within the movement that oftentimes we focus on the generational one, but there's layers upon layers in which identity politics are playing out and people are vying for space.
We're talking with Rahel Tesfamarian about the role of the Black Church in the new civil rights movement. And looking to the past again, there was a role for what you call, the term is liberation theology, seeing Jesus almost as a politicized figure and using that to springboard off into activism. Do you see that liberation theology as having a role in the new civil rights movement that we're seeing right now?
Everywhere I go, I tell people that there is no Jesus without justice. So it's not a matter of politicizing Jesus. Jesus was political in the sense that Jesus came as a form of rebellion, as a form of resistance, that Jesus in breaking where Jesus was born, what is now known as modern-day Palestine, that Jesus merged Jewish culture with Palestinian identity. I mean, all these things were within themselves inherently messages of liberation, that when he resisted the Roman Empire, when he told people, you know, that you've been excluded and alienated and pushed to the margins, but your faith has made you whole, come into the full circle of life, every single thing that Jesus did, even in the miracles that Jesus performed, these were political acts of resistance. He wouldn't have been killed if what he did wasn't radical and against the Roman Empire. That was ultimately what he was persecuted for, that people were worshiping him and idolizing him as a god in the time in which the empire had been set up to be the only law of the land. And it was this idea that, you know, they saw something in Jesus that they knew they weren't getting from the rulers of their day. And so liberation theology is a continuation of what people have found in Jesus throughout the ages. You know, it's people in Palestine, people in the Caribbean, in Africa, that what was meant to be a tool of oppression has been taken by people who are subjugated and been used for their purposes. You know, and that they have found their own relationship. So it's not a form of theology. My opinion is that liberation theology is the theology of Jesus.
And do you think that's still important to this movement?
Well, I find that many young people, many millennials today are not having the same relationship with Jesus, with God, with Allah, with whatever you want to call it. Oftentimes you find that this can in some ways be an a-religious, a-spiritual movement. Part of it is when you really take on the ideology of Black resistance, Black nationalism, and Black radical thought, it often will unveil to you all the ways in which Christianity has been a tool of oppression. What I think is important is for young people to reclaim faith and spirituality. It may not lead you to Christianity, which is where it led me. You may not get there. You may get somewhere very different, but I think that journey is important. Why? Because you need every tool at your disposal. Why give up on the possibility of having faith and spirituality as just another arsenal in your belt? I mean, we need everything, because part of it is faith propels us to the supernatural, to see the world as it should be, not just as it is. And I think that's a powerful mechanism for this generation.
Now, Dr. Martin Luther King, he's celebrated today, revered for his vision, his nonviolence, his passion from the pulpit, and having that sort of crossover between his work as a reverend and as a civil rights leader. Do activists today still talk about him as a role model?
I think Dr. King is going to be an icon, a source of inspiration, a hero, a role model for generations to come. I don't think that there is a young black child growing up in America or anywhere in the world, and at any point in soon-to-be history, that will not be deeply inspired and moved by the legacy of Dr. King, not just because he understood the power of life and death is in the tongue, and he used his words for life, not only because he was willing to sacrifice everything, his personal time, his body, that he sacrificed his life. Many of us are humbled by the fact that regardless of the sacrifices we are willing to make for the black community, we're still alive. And so when you look at a Dr. King, when you look at a Malcolm X, when you think of a Fred Hampton, you think of people who ultimately lost the most precious gift that we have, which is the gift of life, in pursuit of liberation. And so there's a humility that the fact that this man was not able to be a father for the remainder of his children's lives, you know, that he wasn't able to enjoy the riches of being a grandfather. Like, these are things that I think will always make him a source of humility for my generation.
Rahel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Rahel Tesfamarian, a social activist, public theologian, writer, and speaker, and she'll be giving a lecture on the UW-Madison campus tonight. The talk is free and open to the public. There's information about it up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we look at literacy efforts geared toward immigrants and refugees in Wisconsin.